Well, thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here. First time I've visited Toronto when I was a graduate student, but it's been some time back, and I never visited the university. It's a great pleasure to come. I'm going to tell you about efforts of my group to wade in and say some things about amyloid diseases, particularly or the proteins involved in amyloid diseases, particularly the prion or mad cow diseases, hence the title. And it's also nice because, you know, I can put these funny little cows up here, which works very well at UC Davis, which is an agricultural school. I'm also the co-director of something called the Institute for Complex Adaptive Matter, which is a scientific network. And I have to say that had it not been for my getting involved in ICAM a number of years ago, I wouldn't have been able to make a transition into working on biology problems. So if you have some questions about that, I'd be happy to talk to you afterwards. And so this work has been done with a number of students. Over the years, Kay Coons, Sunny Dai, Jamie Romnes, Robert Hare, Cynthia Trevison, currently my long-term collaborator Rajiv Singh, Alex Sleepoy, who parlayed this into a job at Sandia Labs, Rahul Kulkarni, who is now a professor at Virginia Polytechnic, David Mobley, who's actually, this isn't quite right, he's now a professor at New Orleans, Ferenc Pazmandi couldn't stand this work and became a work for a patent law firm now. No, I'm just kidding. But he is working for patent law. Xichen Yang is... I collaborated with at San Diego and is now a postdoc at Chicago. Scott Clark and Evan Olson are undergraduates who I've worked with on this. And I've also collaborated with Herb Levine and Jose Onishik from UC San Diego. Okay, so what I want to talk about is what is amyloid matter? And I should tell you, amyloid is a kind of funny term. It just means that it stains like starch. So can you hear me? Is this coming through? Okay. It stains like starch. And so these particular clumps of protein have had that name attached to them for a long time, but that's all that means. But it's come to be the main term to describe them. And then I'll tell you a little bit about this discrepancy, if you will, or difference between biophysics and biological physics, which is primarily an operational difference, but I'll explain to you what that means. I guess I have a responsibility because I'm on the advisory committee or the executive committee for the Division of Biological Physics of the American Physical Society. And in case you don't know, I'll remind you of the key features for molecular biology that you need to know to make some progress in understanding this stuff. And then I'll get back into the amyloids and say where physicists, I think, can clearly make inroads. Where we have something like precision biology, and I like that term kind of in parallel to precision cosmology, where now all of a sudden cosmology has become a very quantitative and precise science given the conflation of theory and experiment, and we now can do that in a lot of areas of biology, and that's one reason why there's a lot of room for physicists and quantitatively trained scientists to come in. Then I'll switch to talk about prions, and I'll talk about why I think they're interesting, and many people do, why the prions are intrinsically slow, and that may be the explanation to why they're fundamentally a disease of aging, unless you get the infection. And then talk about molecular models of prion proteins relevant to the disease. I'm going to mention actually early on that this stuff isn't just relevant to say mad cow disease or Alzheimer's disease. There's increasing evidence that amyloids may play some role actually in cancer, and in AIDS, and I'll just at least tell you a little bit about that that's from experimental data out there. Okay, so first of all, what we're talking about with amyloid matter is really novel materials. So these are images taken from the Feeney Lab at Harvard. These are your mind on amyloid, so to speak. These are plaques from Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, Huntington's disease, and the Kuru disease, which if you've heard of it, that's the disease that the Foray tribe in New Guinea got from their ritual cannibalism of their dead that Carlton Gajicek worked out was a prion disease, and that got him a Nobel Prize. These are basically kind of yarn balls of protein fibers tucked within the brains of people who've passed away from these diseases. And the presence of these plaques is certainly correlated, at least in some way, with the onset of the disease. And so when I say that it's yarn, if you disentangle them, each one has a majority protein component, which then forms these one-dimensional strings or one-dimensional crystals. These are electron microscopy images from Halal Ashuwal at the EPFL in Lausanne. And these fibrils are really quite remarkable structures, and people have used them to template nanowires, for example. So they already have some utility outside the obvious disutility in the body. And there's one thing in common to all of them. I mean, there's been some hope that there's a universal target structure for these protein filaments or fibrils. That's probably not true. But what is true is that if you go along the axis of the crystal, you find out that the peptide, the polymer backbone of the protein, will in many cases, well, not sorry, it will always have a pieces of it which go perpendicular to the axis of the crystal. And that's a so-called cross-beta structure. And this is fundamental nanoscience to study these things because the dimensions typically are about 5 to 10 nanometers across for these fibrils. Okay, and now there, I should update this. There are probably about 40 known amyloid diseases, and they range from diseases such as systemic amyloid diseases where you literally can get kilograms of this material accumulating in your body, to the neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Huntington's, Lou Gehrig. But also I have here type 2 diabetes, which in the States at least is a very serious problem, and immunoglobulin light chain disease, which you may not have heard of, but actually kills around 10,000 people annually, and then of course the prion diseases. In every case, it's been identified what the protein or peptide is that's involved in those filamentary aggregates inside of those plaques. In almost every case, we don't know what they do. For example, in the prion, there's speculation that the prion protein has been evolved evolutionarily to sort of reduce stress from oxidative products in the vicinity of neuron surfaces, but we don't really know. And the amount of it which is heritable varies from disease to disease. In the case of Huntington's, I'll say more about that, that's 100% inherited. In the case of Alzheimer's, it's believed that heredity plays a role in about 25% of the disease cases. And in prions, it's about 10 to 15%. And then the onset tends to correlate with age. It certainly isn't a perfect correlation, but in general, all of these diseases are diseases of aging. And I've highlighted the Huntington's disease and the prion diseases because you can make a strong case that the dominant factor there is, in fact, that these are very slow kinetics associated with the aggregation of these protein structures that can be correlated with the onset of the disease. And also because in these two cases, there seems to be much less biochemistry involved in understanding at least how you get to the disease state. So there's more of a chance for a contribution from physical scientists. Okay. So now these are just to mention two recent developments, at least to whet your appetite that this is an interesting problem, if I haven't already. Cancer. There's two separate regions of the P53 protein. What does P53 do? Well, P53 can trigger programmed cell death. So if you've got a tumor and the P53 is turned on, it can kill the tumor to keep it from propagating. That's good. Or it can reset the cell cycle and possibly arrest the tumor progress that way. But what can happen is there's two separate regions of this big P53 protein which can aggregate in the same kind of filamentary way. And if it aggregates in this filamentary way, then the P53 loses its function, and therefore the tumor cells can propagate. Another example that just came up last year in a paper in Cell, there's a protein in semen called HPAP, which can fragment naturally inside the semen. It turns out that those fragments can aggregate into these amyloids, and they bind HIV virus. So the thought is that if HIV then gets into a woman, then it can hang out for a lot longer if it's bound to these amyloid fragments, and that this could have a lot to do with the greater susceptibility of women to get infection than men to get infected by women. And so this could be a very important point because the enhancement of infectivity can be by factors of 10 to 100 as measured in the laboratory. What we don't know here is we know that these aggregates can form, but we have no idea at all what the structure of these aggregates is. In only two cases of these filamentary structures of existing natural proteins do we have high-resolution structures of the fibrils. And there are many of them out there, obviously, that we'd like to know. By the way, feel free to interrupt me with questions at any time if something's unclear. So now into sort of a fun part. I guess probably beginning in about the 1970s, there was an effort to create sort of what's called biological physics versus biophysics. And I don't have a real axe to grind here, but at least I want to give you a rationale for why this was done in the States, at least. So the old model of biophysics, in some sense, is a one-way flow of ideas and people, and it's been around for quite a while. So that you take methods and actually people from the physical sciences, and you migrate them over to biology. And that has included, you know, the application of magnetic resonance techniques, of course, X-ray diffraction, various EM techniques. In fact, just as a proof that this is an interesting point, I was actually the first physicist to join the UC Davis biophysics grad group, which has been in existence at Davis since 1961. So there's clearly something different about biophysics and biological physics, I think, in that sense. And so biological physics, at the very least, keeps those same people in physics departments, which isn't a bad thing. And it says, ask not, this is a good quote that sort of defines it by Stan Ulam, by way of Hans Fraunfelder, ask not what physics can do for biology, but what biology can do for physics. Meaning that you can study biological problems as interesting problems of the physical world and try to ask the kinds of questions that we find interesting as physicists, at least. And in practice, then there's a two-way flow of ideas. So that you take a physics style to identify relevant degrees of freedom and quantitative models for those, and therefore identify quantitative organizing principles for the relevant types of biological matter, and you apply those to biological problems, and in turn, you can have some of the biology feed back into the physics. For example, the landscape paradigms that have emerged from protein folding have been ported over to some extent to studies of M theory or string theory, where now we're getting whatever it is, 10 to the 500 solutions to M theory. So people are talking about what is the landscape of cosmologies that's possible. There are, of course, caveats. I love this joke. Just because you can throw a dog off a roof to measure G doesn't mean you're doing biological physics. I mean, there's always the possibility that you could be trapped in some physics ivory tower and not be doing something that's really biologically relevant. But on the other hand, we can certainly study these biological problems with physics ideas and methods. And we need some humility because, of course, there's lots of ways of being smart in this world that don't exist just in physics departments. It took me a while to learn that, but I think I finally understand that after getting my head knocked around a little bit. But we shouldn't also be cowed by the jargon or expertise outside of the physics departments. And I also like this. I think it's appropriate here, but Martin Pearl gave these wonderful lectures for young scientists at Davis, and he was the discoverer of the tau lepton, and he's moved on to more speculative experiments, and he said, whenever you enter a new field, don't ask too much and watch out for fast talkers, which means you probably should, you know, keep a grain of salt about me today, but anyway. So what can biological physics ask and say about amyloid diseases? Well, these were the kind of questions that got us interested. So first of all, are these diseases of aging, meaning that there really is more complicated aging biology and biochemistry involved, which makes it harder to unravel the science and certainly requires much more collaboration with people? Or is it possible that, at least in some cases, they're just plain slow and that you can get some of the key ingredients from modeling the very slow kinetics of these amyloid aggregation processes? So for example, can we model the onset distribution of the disease? Another thing, what are the organizing principles of the relevant protein structures? I showed you already these fibrils. There's also oligomers, and I'll indicate to you why oligomers, which could be precursors to the fibrils, smaller aggregates of proteins, are probably, in fact, the most important players for the disease. And how can we constrain these possible structures from data and make falsifiable predictions? Do the structures suggest or correlate with toxicity mechanisms? I'll say a little bit about that. And can the structures be modified by interacting with other atoms or molecules? And I won't have time to really say anything about that, but that's another important area. For example, metal atoms attaching to the proteins. And it really is frontier nanoscience. I mean, part of the problem is, part of the room for theory here, is that we can't reliably probe these structures in the biological environment at the scale of interest, at the nanometer scale. We can pull them out and look at them with AFM or TEM, but then you're pulling them out of the biological environment. Or we can grow those fibrils in a test tube, but the fibrils you grow in a test tube aren't guaranteed to be the relevant fibrils inside the cell. So it really is frontier nanoscience, and the room for theory here, which is where I'm coming from, is that we can try to develop models that are constrained by the data that have falsifiable predictions and therefore can at least be ruled in or out and drive further experiments. And so in case you aren't familiar with it, I call this sort of biological physics the early years, tour of the central dogma and my bad spelling. In some ways, biological physics isn't really new. This guy, for example, Schrodinger, wrote a beautiful book, maybe some of you have read it, called What is Life, that came from some lectures he gave at Trinity College in the 40s. And one of the things that's really remarkable in this book is that he predicted, here's the quote, I won't bother to read it all to you, but he predicted that DNA would be an aperiodic crystal a few years before it was proven to be so by Watson and Crick in analyzing the data from Rosalind Franklin's experiments. So that got a lot of people excited at the time, and there was a big migration of physicists into biology, including people like Perutz, Crick, Delbruck, Monod. And of course, at that time, then the central dogma of molecular biology emerged. So you have the information for proteins, which are the main machines of the body that get all the work done. The information for proteins is encoded in the DNA, transcribed by the DNA to RNA, and then translated into proteins with these fabulous molecular machines, so that there's actually a code that tells you which bases of the four, G, guanine, G, U, A, C, which one of those guys, if you put three of them together, they each code for amino acid, and then you replace the U by a T for DNA, it's a very similar base, thymine, and then you basically have a unique matching of these groups of three of these bases from the RNA or the DNA to amino acids as you assemble the amino acids. And the amino acids, by the way, this is kind of a remarkable question in its own right. Crick worked this out with a student in the 1960s, but why this particular pattern? I have no idea. There's 20 amino acids coded for, plus a stop codon in higher organisms. And why this particular pattern of codons, I don't know, but it's a pretty interesting question in its own right. And then the amino acids, of course, have this this structure that you have an amide group. This will be about as big as the chemistry goes here. You have an amide group here, a carbon in the middle that has a side chain that gives the amino acid its unique properties, and a carbonyl on the other end. And those side chains could be as simple as a proton or as complicated as, say, this ring on phenylalanine over here. And then you can string these, you can form peptide bonds to string these amino acids together into peptides, into long polymers. And the primary structure of a protein or a peptide is simply that polymer sequence. Then you can form secondary structure, I'll say a little bit more about in a minute, where you form local hydrogen bonds that collapse the structure partially. And then you can collapse those secondary structures into a tertiary structure. And this process is known as the protein folding problem, which I'll say more about in a minute. And the most common secondary structures, just to keep this in mind for what I say later, you don't really have to remember anything else about the protein structures other than this, are either these alpha helices, which can be left-handed or right-handed. Those are just mirror images of each other, where along the alpha helix, every 3 to 4 amino acids, one of the oxygens that's attached to a carbon will share a proton with the nitrogen in another amino acid and form a so-called hydrogen bond. And that's a very local bonding process. The other primary secondary structure, the other kind of secondary structure which appears frequently is a beta structure, where you can have sort of a sheet in which the backbone will run this way, and you will share, the red here is oxygen, the blue is nitrogen, you will share a proton between these on neighboring chains. And the spacing here is about 5.4 angstroms on the pitch of the alpha helix, and the spacing here is a little under 5 angstroms for the beta sheets. And one thing that's interesting to notice here is that whenever you have edges on the beta sheets, those are kind of hungry for bonds. And that means you can easily take beta sheets and stack them together, because these oxygens here could bind to the nitrogens of a neighboring beta sheet that would come along. And that's why these form such primary units for the building up of these amyloids. And usually one represents these by a kind of ribbon, where the ribbon runs from the amide group to the carboxyl group. So you'd have a ribbon running, an arrow running this way, an arrow running this way. So this would be anti-parallel beta sheet, and a ribbon running this way. You can also form parallel beta sheet structures. Okay. Now, the protein folding problem. Why is there a protein folding problem, and what does this have to do with amyloids? The protein folding problem has occupied a lot of biological physicists over the last 20 or 30 years. And the basic problem is this. The proteins are random heteropolymers. Random heteropolymers act like a glassy system, okay? And what does that mean? Well, they basically don't fold into compact shapes because there's frustration in glassy systems. There's unsatisfiable competing interactions arising, for example, from you have to put some residues pointing out towards the water, some amino acids with their side chains pointing out towards the water because they like water, and you have to put some amino acids with their side chains pointing away from water. All these proteins are in water in the cell because they are hydrophobic. They're like oil, and they don't like to be close to water. So there's frustration. Now, the reality is that the proteins in our body fold to useful shapes on timescales of seconds to milliseconds. So how do we get that to happen? And here's the problem, the Leventhal paradox. If you estimate the number of different conformations for, say, a length 100 random heteropolymer, it would be something like 10 to the 300th conformations. And the timescale for sampling those is probably about a picosecond, which is the molecular motion timescale, sort of the terahertz timescale. And so if you say, how could you possibly get to unique conformation? What would be the average time to get to unique conformation? Going through all those, that search time is enormous. The estimate that you would get for length 100 would be something like the order of 10 to the 48th universe lifetimes. That's a little long for our body. So that's called the protein folding problem. How can you understand how to get these guys to fold to unique and useful shapes on a time scale of seconds to milliseconds? And the answer, which is not quite, I would say, a full theory, but a very quantitative scenario, is that if you have a minimally frustrated sequence of amino acids that you can tune for through evolution, through natural selection, then that minimally frustrated sequence can find its way to a energy minimum. So the landscape of a random heteropolymer would typically be very flat with a lot of minima in it, like a glass. But if you have a well-defined sequence, there can be one minimum which is picked out, and there are a lot of configurations which flow into that funnel. So it's been shown how you can take well-designed sequences and generate such funnels on a model basis. And this is called the protein folding funnel that derives from so-called minimal frustration, where minimal frustration, again, is provided by evolution. Okay, let's see. So there's a little, you know, bumps and wiggles on this landscape, but it's not a flat and rugged landscape like you would have for a glass. And this measures the number of conformations or the entropy going this way, and this measures the energy going this way. And the people who've worked on this are Peter Wallness and Jose Onishik, or the people who are generally given credit for the funnel. Wallness and Onishik at San Diego, and independently Shaknovich at Harvard and Dill at UC San Francisco. You can actually really work out quantitative theories coming from the sort of glass perspective applied to this kind of model. This paper is a famous one about 20 years ago by Wallness and Bringelson, where this measures frustration along this axis. This measures design stability from a well-designed sequence along this axis. And if you have low enough frustration, then you can have very fast folding along here. But if you're up here, you wind up having high frustration, and it's very glassy, and you're in the Leventhal paradox regime. So within a model, you can actually capture the relevant features of the protein folding problem. Okay, so what about amyloid proteins? Well, now we have to some extent throw that out, and here's why. It turns out that most of the amyloid proteins are either completely random or have large stretches which are random that are involved in the formation of these structures, these amyloid structures. So the stabilization of the structure actually seems to come with aggregation. It's not driven by well-designed sequences. It's driven by aggregation. And then whether in fibril or in oligomer form, there's cross-beta structure in all of these forms. This is probably the generic state of protein matter, the generic endpoint of protein matter, as opposed to the well-folded proteins, which are exceptions that evolution has picked out for us. And you might ask yourself, why would the body have these things around then? I mean, if they're going to tend to aggregate, why would the body have them around? And I think that still remains an excellent question that we don't know the full answer to. They have some function, apparently, but we have no idea what. Okay, and this is just to give you an idea about the experimental evidence for this cross-beta structure. These are fiber, so you sort of orient the fibers in a kind of a fiber powder, if you will, and then you do X-ray diffraction on the fiber powder. You won't get good resolution transverse, but you can get good resolution along the fiber. And these are oriented so that the spacing of these concentric rings corresponds in reciprocal space to 2 pi over the 4.8 angstroms. So each one of these arrows points to a ring that corresponds to that 4.8 angstroms of the beta sheet formation. And these are 8 different amyloid fibrils here. So this is what you see all the time. Now, the details of the transverse structure of those fibrils could be very different, but you do see this kind of thing all the time when you do X-ray scattering off of these fibers. Okay, so why is the beta sheet prone to aggregation again? Well, for example, here's a couple of different pictures of why this would work. You can have an unstructured peptide that starts out with an amino group over here and winds all the way to a carboxyl group over here. You can form a sort of beta structure out of one of those, and then if another one comes up, it can first bind with beta structure to this one, and then it can start to form its own beta structure, so you nucleate the growth of a filamentary structure. You could also do it a different way. Instead of forming a kind of flat structure like this, you could have beta bonding in a helix. That's so-called beta helix. And then you can bring another peptide up along, and you can start to do the beta bonding going up the axis this way. So there's different ways, but the beta sheet formation, because of these hungry hydrogen bonds along here and along here, the hungry empty hydrogen bonds along there, you can always tend to aggregate these things edge to edge. And so this is a natural one for aggregation of proteins. Now, amyloids can be bad. They can kill you with Alzheimer's. But they can also be good, at least for some organisms. This is E. coli. And E. coli, in a position of stress, where they may want to form biocolonies or biofilms to form a protective environment, they actually will start, as they sense the stress, they will actually start to form these amyloid fibrils on their surface by a combination of two different proteins, one that templates the growth of the fibril, and that's how they control it. And then those fibrils allow them to detect each other, get together, and then they stop growing the fibrils, and they form the biocolony completely. So that's good for them, not necessarily good for you if the biocolony forms in your intestine or something, but it's good for them. Spider silk. The amazing tensile strength of spider silk has at least something to do with amyloids. It turns out that 25% of the really strong spider silk, the dragline spider silk that the spider hangs on, 25% of that has amyloid fibrils in it, and the rest of it is randomly oriented protein. Some insect eggs seem to be made up of sort of nested amyloid fibrils. And they've been used in tissue engineering, where you can have reversible amyloid scaffolds. And another interesting place is that there are prions in yeast and fungal cells, where they don't actually damage the yeast and fungal cells, but they provide a useful heredity to the yeast and fungal cells. I can tell you more about that if you're interested, but it's certainly not harmful. It's actually a useful way of conveying information outside the genome, heritable information outside the genome. Okay, and here's the beautiful. So I guess we had the bad, which is the disease, the good, which is these controlled amyloid formation. And the beautiful, I think, is what are the organizing principles for amyloid matter? And let me give you some ideas of what people think about. Well, I mentioned this idea of minimal frustration, where by evolutionary design, you can have proteins which will quickly fold to compact shapes by a funneled energy landscape. Here's an example of a protein, human cystatin. There you see the alpha helical structure. So all of the atomic detail of those amino acids is thrown out here, and you're just showing the general way that the backbone stacks up in this so-called cartoon or ribbon structure. Well, one way you can form an aggregate out of this at high enough concentrations is you can domain swap. This will never be favorable at low concentrations, but it can be favorable at high concentrations. And the idea here is that you take, say, the top rung from this sheet of beta strands. And so I take the green one, and I take it to over here and bind it to these three blue ones of this protein. And then I take the blue strand over here, and I bind it to those three green ones. So I take one domain of the protein, and I just swap it so it makes the same interactions, but with its neighboring protein instead of that one. And that is a way that will definitely generate fibrils. And here's sort of an in view of that to show that you could stack them up and start to form a ribbon of beta sheets. Some theory work by the San Diego group, Xichen Yang, for example, Peter Walness, or Jose Onoshek, and others, has shown that this is you can very naturally extend the minimal frustration concept developed for individual proteins to explain aggregation by this process. Here's another organizing principle discovered experimentally by the Eisenberg group. They took short lengths of amino acid peptides, about 8 amino acids, whereas the full-length peptides in the body that do this are typically 40 or more amino acids. They took short links from Alzheimer's disease, I mean proteins, from prion proteins, from yeast, from et cetera, and then they let them aggregate, and they talked about the so-called steric zipper. So the idea there is a combination of the side chains of the amino acid locking together like a zipper, and then having the beta sheet aggregation perpendicular to that zipper allows you to generate these structures. And they identified, based on parallel and anti-parallel beta structures, 8 unique ways to do these steric zippers. And they've found experimental examples of 5 of those. Now, whether this is the story for all of the amyloid proteins involved in disease isn't clear, because these are such short links of peptides. But it's a very interesting set of organizing principles that people want to follow up on. And you can also simply take known existing beta structures and stack them up. Here is a real beta helix that's found in an enzyme in bacteria. It turns out if you put in the atomic details, there are 18 amino acids per turn of this beta helix, which is really amazing. I mean, why nature would form such a structure with 18, I have no idea. If a student figured that out, I'd give them a dissertation, you know, right off the bat if they came up with a simple model. Pauling predicted the alpha helix before it was discovered, but that's just, you know, 3 amino acids away, say. But this is 18. It's quite interesting. And it forms a nice triangular cross-section. As I'll say more about, that's been useful as a model for the prion protein. And then you can just stack those up to start to form a filament where the beta sheet edges on one side can match up to the beta sheet edges on another side. Okay, so now let me start getting into where you can become more quantitative and talk about understanding these things. So it turns out, it got cut off at the top here, but Huntington's disease is a disease that is completely inherited. And the most famous person who's passed away from Huntington's disease is Woody Guthrie, the folk singer. And you'll find an article typically about every 2 years in the front page of the New York Times talking about people who've been genetically screened for Huntington's disease. What happens in this and in 10 other similar diseases is that the proteins wind up with lots of repeats of the amino acid glutamine. Typically, in any one of us here in the room, if we have the Huntington protein, which corresponds to this part of this figure right here. If you have the Huntington protein, you'll find about 20 of these glutamines in that particular stretch. When you get Huntington's disease, you inherit about 40 of those in that particular stretch. And if you wind up with 40 of those, this is a plot of the number of repeats of glutamine versus the onset age of the disease. With 40, you come into the human lifespan. You'll actually typically have an onset of the disease at the age of 65. It's very reproducible, and the same trend is true for all 10 of these diseases. I've just shown 5 of them here. It just completely correlates with the number of glutamines that you have present. So this was a study done by another group that points at this idea of intrinsically slow disease by intrinsically slow aggregation. It doesn't tell you what the method of toxicity is of the disease, but just tells you that you can correlate the onset time with the slowness here. So what this was Chin, Ferrone, and Wetzel. And what they did was they took links of poly-Q and put them in a test tube to aggregate. And they would study how much of them aggregated by a dye that's sensitive to amyloid structure. This is length 48 poly-Qs. This is length 36, and this is length 28. So you can see that as you shorten the peptide, the aggregation time increases. And let me ask any students or any faculty or whatever, whoever in the audience, what's the simplest functional form that you could use to describe these curves right here? Parabola, yeah, t squared, very good. You can collect your check later. It turns out that it's the simplest functional form is a parabola, and that the coefficient of that parabola, for simple reasons, is proportional to a power of the concentration of the aggregating system. So it's a really simple phenomenology that gives you a simple and robust phenomenology that will give you that parabola. Well, what you can do is you can extrapolate from these test tube concentrations, which are on a graduate student timescale of about a day or two to get enough aggregate. You can extrapolate those down to physiological concentrations, and then you better go to a log scale. Because when you go to the physiological concentrations, these parabolas now start to get knees, for example, for length 47 at about 50 years, for length 36 at about 500 years, and for length 28 at about 5,000 years. So the suggestion here is that we're protected from, if we live to 10,000 years, all of us would probably be susceptible to Huntington's disease, But those people who inherit long links of those polyQs are susceptible because the aggregation starts to set in already within a lifespan of 70 years, say. Okay. A little bit more. This is to connect this to the beta helix structure. So these poly-Q diseases have a critical insert number of about 36. That's when you start to see these diseases with onsets in a human lifetime. Now, let's see. I mentioned, if I go back a couple slides, and I'll just show you this picture for a second, that the number of repeats in one of these beta helices is 18. So the first stable structure you could form from that, where you satisfy all of the hydrogen bonds internally, is if you put two of those together. That's 18 plus 18, or 36. Pretty suggestive. So you can't prove that that's the structure of these things in vivo because it's hard to study them. They don't crystallize. You can't study them with solution NMR because they precipitate out. But what you could do is you could make beta helical structures with that number of residues on the computer and see if they're stable. And that's what Stork et al. Did a few years back. So they formed a two-turn beta helix of poly-Q on the computer. They studied it with molecular dynamics, which is this technique of essentially using Newton's laws for an approximate potential derived from quantum mechanics to study the evolution of these molecules in solution. And they found that if you measured the root mean square deviation of the atoms from their starting position, that the top layer was pretty stable, but the bottom layer started to come undone, so the whole structure was coming undone. On the other hand, if they made a three-layer structure, that was really quite stable. Now, this at least suggests the possibility that somewhere between two and three layers, you could start to stabilize the beta helix, and that could be a unit for building up these aggregates implicated in Huntington's disease. And again, it points to this intrinsic slowness. And so the idea of the stability is that you go out to 10 nanoseconds of simulation time, and basically the structure is holding up. It's not coming undone. Okay. So from organizing to principle to disease, one possibility, oligomers. Fibrils are not perfectly correlated with disease. Many people have these plaques in their brains, but they don't wind up with Alzheimer's disease. And in some cases, people who die of prion disease wind up having no plaques in their brains. So they're not perfectly correlated with disease. They're weakly correlated with disease. And in fact, some people think that the growth of these fibrils, these very big structures, that then coalesce into these plaques could be protective by sort of sequestering these nasty aggregates away from the cells. On the other hand, on the way to forming these fibrils, you form oligomers. And those oligomers can, for example, do the following. They can form donuts or pores. Those pores can insert themselves into membranes. So these are pores on an electron microscopy stage formed from the A-beta protein in Alzheimer's, from the superoxide dismutase protein in Lou Gehrig disease, from alpha-synuclein in Parkinson's. And then these are images of those same kinds of pores sitting on supported lipid bilayers, which are mimicking cell membranes. You put those on top of silicon surfaces in solution, and they mimic cell membranes. So these actually permeate the cell membranes, and you can pass calcium through there. If you put too much calcium into a cell, it will kill the cell. It'll kill it by programmed cell death through apoptosis. So it's believed, in fact, in general, whether this is the universal mechanism or whether it's a mechanism that may apply to some of the diseases, it's believed that these oligomers are the key to understanding toxicity. There's some other examples of mechanisms I can tell you about, but this is a simple one to explain. So I'll just leave that with you for right now. Okay, so now what about prions? Special thing about prions. They're the only disease known to humans which can be infectious, which can be spontaneous. There's no known proximate heritable or infectious cause, or they can be inherited, the only disease. Prion itself stands for protonaceous infectious particle. Prusner, who won the Nobel Prize for identifying the protein involved in this, coined this phrase in the 1980s, and it's the idea of the minimal unit of infectivity associated with this disease. And it's also noticed by me that PR are the first two letters in Prusner's name. And PR also stands for PR, which is useful in this game. Among other amyloid diseases, as I mentioned, it's possible infectious, sporadic, or inherited. What's really, of course, fascinating is that as an infectious disease, you don't need nucleic acids. The nature of the disease is encoded in the structure of the protein conformation somehow, so that there is a good form of the protein, which is called PRPC, and a bad form of the protein, which is called PRP scrapie. A little bit more about that in a minute. So all kinds of experiments suggest that there's no need for nucleic acids to get this disease. Bolstered by test tube synthesis experiments, it seems pretty clear that you can't quite get the infectious material from proteins in a test tube only, almost. If you throw in some polyanions, some negative ions, along with the prion protein in a test tube, you can then infect animals. So you grow the aggregate in a test tube in the presence of these polyanions, and then you can infect animals with it. That, again, is offering good proof that you don't need the nucleic acids and that it's not a virus or a bacteria giving you this disease. Prusiner isolated the relevant protein called the PRPC protein as the key to the disease and proved it by knocking the gene for that out of mice. And we knocked that gene out of mice and inoculated them directly with the infectious material. Those mice didn't get sick. So that proved that you had to have this protein to get the disease. And some examples are scrapies for sheep, the Kuru disease among the Foray tribe in New Guinea from ritual cannibalism, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is a spontaneous form, mad cow disease. And some of you may know that in parts of the United States, there's chronic wasting disease, which surely will come to Canada, for deer and elk in Wisconsin, Montana, Colorado, Wyoming, places like that. So I'm pretty sure it'll probably migrate to Canada. It so far doesn't look like it's transmissible from the deer and the elk to humans. This is the structure of the normal prion protein, and it turns out that there are these three alpha helices, one little piece of beta, and then a lot of random stuff, and it's the random stuff, it's the random stuff that's implicated in the amyloid formation that gives rise to the disease. That protein has the same sequence in 90 to 95% of mammals. It seems to be present in some form in all vertebrates, so it's an ancient protein. Whatever it's good for, vertebrates like it. And it binds copper, and that probably has something to do with the function, but we don't know what. This is a picture I'll show you again a little bit later, but this is a two-dimensional crystal of this amyloid prion protein. Each one of these little donuts seems to be one infectious oligomer of the prion disease. And a model for this was that these oligomers are actually three proteins together where each individual protein forms one of these beta helices. Hence, we're back to these beta helices again. This was found by the Prusiner lab a few years back. A little bit more about what's special about the prion disease in terms of the quantitative aspects for a physicist to study. You can do these dose incubation studies. You take a particular dose from infected animals, you reinfect other animals by direct inoculation into the brain, and the distribution of onset times, incubation times, the distribution of those incubation times is very reproducible from animal to animal. What's also reproducible is the time course of the disease. This is a log plot, and so you usually find a lag phase after inoculation followed by a phase of exponential growth. And you need exponential growth for the replication, just like with viruses and bacteria in an illness. And that exponential growth is unique among these amyloid diseases to the prion disease. The prion diseases also have this kind of universality that in countries where the lifespan is long enough, about 1 in 1 million people get the spontaneous form. So it does suggest there's something relatively universal about the time scale involved in these diseases. So what are the kinds of questions that we were interested in asking? I'll show you a little bit about kinetics, and then I'll show you a little bit about molecular modeling, and then I'll finish my presentation. But basically, again, there's two different forms of the protein. And the simplest model that goes back to a paper by a mathematician, Griffin, in 1967, is you got a good form, that's the circle here, PRP cellular, PRPC, and a bad form, PRP scrapie, named after the scrapie disease in sheep. So the circle is good, the square is bad, and there's something called autocatalysis, where whenever a good guy comes in contact with a bad guy, the good guy is converted to a bad guy. That will give you exponential growth, obviously, and aggregation would follow. Now it seems that what really goes on in the body is probably something more complicated, because usually the conversion will occur upon attachment to the aggregate. So there are questions about autocatalysis versus autocatalytic aggregation. And if straight autocatalysis doesn't explain the exponential growth, probably it's some fission of these aggregates. And then like nuclear fission, you can get the exponential growth out. And then there's a question about how you can reconcile the timescales. So one thing that we were interested in is the prion protein, when you make it, you express it out to the surface of the cells. So it sits on the surface of nerve cells, and then after a while of sitting out there, it gets recycled back in. So the prions are membrane bound. And so we were interested in trying to come up with a kinetic model for the prions, which involved two-dimensional aggregation. And so just to convince you that we can at least make movies. So these red guys are a seed of the bad prion protein injected on a model neuron surface. We allow that to diffuse around, and then we put some of the normal prion protein on. And this is a very simple cellular automata model. Whenever a good prion protein comes in contact with the bad prion protein, if there's enough of the bad protein around, it can convert itself. If there's not enough of the bad protein around, it just detaches and goes back out. And after a while, you'll wind up generating these larger aggregates, which actually can grow more rapidly. And then the idea is once these get big enough, either by undulation in the membrane surface or something like that, they can break, and then you'll have the exponential growth. And so one question we wanted to do with such a cellular automata model was ask whether we could understand a difference between the timescales of spontaneous and infected prion disease, and whether we could understand something about the incubation time distribution of prion disease. And I can't go into all the details of this, but I want to just flash a picture to convince you that it's not a completely crazy idea. So the model is we put in a seed, which, for example, for the poor cattle who died from this in England, they had this infected protein stock with the bad prion proteins in it, ate it, went through their digestive tract, made it to their central nervous system. Very few of those seeds got to their brain, and then it wound up replicating. So we put in dilute concentration of seeds, let them aggregate to a critical size where they can break, and we assume that the incubation time distribution is dominated by the time it takes to aggregate to this critical size. So here are results of numerical experiments, five different concentrations of these prions on our model neuron surface. They all collapse if you plot the time over the peak time. And this is the time it takes to get to a critical aggregate size, which will then break. And the hypothesis is that the fluctuations here would be what would give rise to the breadth of any incubation time distribution. Is this hypothesis reasonable? Well, independently, epidemiologists in England took these points from mad cow disease and did a best fit incubation time distribution to the epidemiology of 300,000 cattle in England. And their best fit incubation time distribution has really exactly the same shape. It doesn't prove we're right, but it does prove it's plausible that this kind of idea of slow aggregation followed by fast fission might explain the incubation time distribution of the cattle. One other point. If you tried to let this happen spontaneously by putting in no seed, it's a big barrier because you have to get quite a few of the proteins to behave cooperatively in order to form that first seed. And so it would turn out that the time scale at which you would get this would be about 1,000 times, 100 or 1,000 times away in time from this particular peak right here. Now, if you match this peak up with the time scale known for incubation times in humans from the Kuru disease in New Guinea, this would be about 10 years. It takes about 10 years from when you ingest the bad prions to when you get the disease for Kuru. So that would say that the spontaneous prion disease would sit, 100 or 1,000 times that, so that would be 1,000 to 10,000 years out here. And why is that interesting? Because then very few people would get that, only the few unlucky ones with the tiny tail of the distribution that extends down into the human lifespan. So that we could account for the differences in principle between spontaneous and infectious prion disease that way. Okay, let's see. Another aspect of kinetics is involving the membrane. Let me back that up for a second. Oops, another aspect of kinetics involves the membrane. A group a few years ago had transgenically engineered mice so that the little piece that attaches to the prion and allows it to tether to the membrane was detached. So then the prions are produced in the cell nucleus, they migrate out to the surface of the cell, and then like a spacewalker with no tether, they just go out into the intracellular space and float out there. They're not recycled or anything. And that wound up giving them an amount of infectious, if they then inoculated those mice with infectious material, they would grow infectious prion material inside the brains, but it just kept growing. And if you ask what the shape of this is, it's the same T-squared shape that we talked about before. On the other hand, if you took mice without that genetic engineering and you inoculated them with the same dose of infectious material, you get this lag time, exponential growth, and saturation as you killed off all the neurons. And that would happen after about 150 days. So we pointed out that this proves something interesting. This proves that you can actually take that data from those transgenic mice, fit it to a T-squared law, and use that same T-squared analysis, that same kinetic analysis that we used for the Huntington's disease, to show, first of all, there's no exponential growth without the membrane. So whatever gives you the exponential growth, you need the membrane for it. That proves that. And number two, we could work out what the concentration was and found that, not surprisingly, because there's no recycling of the prions, that the concentration of the prion protein outside the cell for the transgenic mice is about 30 times that for the normal mice. And so that actually winds up, without the exponential growth, giving you a little bit of speed up of the disease formation. But the mice don't get sick. They don't. These mice with this this membrane anchor dropped, these mice don't get sick. They don't die from the disease. So the membrane is crucial for toxicity, and the membrane is crucial for the exponential growth. Okay, so that's just a little side story about the kinetics. Now, the thing I'll close on is a few comments about models, molecular models, which is where we're hanging out right now. I showed you this picture before, and any of the condensed matter physicists in the crowd should at least appreciate that this is a beautiful two-dimensional crystal. And you can see its hexagonal symmetry with this beautiful hexagonal facets emerging off of it. They just stumbled across these two-dimensional crystals of infectious prion aggregate in the lab at Prusner's lab and then did this electron microscopy. And now you can do signal averaging, and you can do a couple of different stainings on it. Without going into the details, the stainings with gold nanoparticles prove that the alpha helical part that's left over on the prion will sit out around the edge of one of these donuts here. And with urinal dye staining, you see a threefold pattern in the middle. And it turns out that you can take this known bacterial enzyme that has that beta helical structure that I talked about, and you can plop it right on top of that threefold pattern. So that got them excited. They said, well, let's do this. Let's take the prion protein, take part of the random part, and make it look beta helical like this, and then make a trimer out of it, and we can drop it right on top of our data. It agrees within the resolution, and the resolution here is not atomic scale. The resolution here is about 1.5 nanometers. And so when I went to San Diego on sabbatical, the second time I met Ken, when I went to San Diego on sabbatical, we got kind of excited about looking at this because we thought, well, how stable is this structure? In this bacterial enzyme, it turns out there's some glue holding those monomers together. And the glue is covalent bonding with zinc atoms. But there's no such glue on the model structure proposed by the UC San Francisco group. So we thought, what holds it together? And we took the molecular dynamics approach. We used this approximate solution of Newton's laws, threw it on the computer to see what happened, and it turned out it blew up. It didn't hold together at all. But you can solve the problem and make them hold together if you do the domain swap. So with the domain swap, we took the top layer of each one of the three members of the trimer, swapped it around cyclically, and that held the whole thing together. So this is a suggestion, at least, that maybe these infectious prion oligomers, if this model is right, maybe these infectious prion oligomers have this domain swap present, and we suggested some falsifiable tests of the model. Now the plot thickens. More recently, in a test tube, not necessarily from an animal, but in a test tube, the Sable and Collins labs in England have grown these incredible fibrils. So these are electron microscopy images of the electron density. And they've also, of course, done diffraction. And these fibrils have a sort of double helix-like look to them. Along each of these strands from the diffraction, the evidence is that there's cross-beta structure with a whole bunch of stuff in between. And the evidence is also that the alpha helical part that's supposed to be present in the normal prion is completely lost in these fibrils. The spacing here is 60 angstroms. Now, if you remember, I said it's about 5 angstroms for each one of those beta strands. So 60 divided by 5 is 12. You could pack 12 of those beta strands in to each one of these repeat units on each side. So we started thinking, could we make a model for this using beta helices? The resolution on this is even lower. It's 3 nanometers resolution on this structure. So you don't get atomic level detail, but you have a lot of constraints to try to put together a model for that structure. And so what we did was we focused on taking a beta helix out of this region, which is what the UCSF group did, Well, we knew we had to get rid of the alpha helices, so we decided let's convert this to a beta helix also. It turns out there's a covalent bond between two amino acids called cysteines right here that hold these two alpha helices together. And the only way that we could make a beta helix out of that was if we put the cysteines on a corner. That's a detail. The important point is that poor physicists trying to figure out how to take the sequence and match it to the structure here didn't even have to think. Once we put that on a corner, we were basically done and we got a beautiful structure out. So we form a beta helix from here, a beta helix from here, with some interconnecting stuff in the middle, and then we can play Tinker Toys. And we could form 8 different repeat units that we could try to build the fibrils out of. So these are color-coded. Each pink one here is one protein. Each green one is one protein. And there are 8 different ways to interconnect those to make building blocks for those fibrils. But it turns out that to fit the fibrils, only these 3 will actually be available to fit the fibrils. And we took this one in particular and showed that both in the transverse cross-section going this way and in just a 3-dimensional fit, we could stuff it right into the fibril model, the fibril data coming from the Collinge and Sable group. Now this, of course, everybody picked up on. I'm joking, but for this model, methionine at position 129 along the 230 amino acid prion protein contacts aspartic acid at position 178. Why do we care about that? I'll tell you more in a minute, but just keep in mind that methionine here contacts aspartic acid at 178. These two amino acids come into contact in this model. Keep that in mind. I'll come back to it. That might be showing why this is of relevance biologically. But to be good theorists, we have to show that we're not just building Tinker Toy models. We have to show that there's some stability. And here's an example of that. We use that same molecular dynamics technique. Again, this is the root mean square deviation of the atoms from their starting position. This is 10 nanoseconds of simulation time, which takes, I don't know, about a week per simulation. And this red one here and this black one are known proteins from the protein database that are really stable. And then these are two of our models with the beta helices showing that the building blocks hold together pretty well on this time scale. That is, they're flat, they don't blow apart. Okay, now let me just come back to convince you that this isn't just fitting some experimental data. There might be some biological relevance. Okay, so again, for this particular model, which is one that can fit the experimental data, amino acid at 129 contacts amino acid at 178. Why do we care? Because it turns out that there is a disease where if you have amino acid, aspartic acid at 178 mutate to asparagine, you'll come down with fatal familial insomnia. And basically, the name of the disease tells you what happens. It's present in a few Italian and German families. The hypothesis is that somehow the kinetics, the process of converting from the bad form, the good form of the prion protein to the bad form of the prion protein is speeded up in fatal familial insomnia. So instead of it typically happening out there, remember, at 1,000 years, it would happen at, say, 40 years, which is the onset age for this disease. Another interesting point is that the amino acid right next to it, if you go to dogs have a different amino acid right next to that same D178. Dogs have arginine, which is a much bigger amino acid than this histidine present in humans. Why do we care about that? Dogs ate that same infected protein stuff that killed cattle in England, but they didn't die. That's pretty interesting. So what happens if we try to build a model where we contact the methionine at 129 to these guys? Well, the methionine has a sulfur on it. That sulfur can hydrogen bond to this nitrogen here of the histidine so that you could start to get a growth of the structure if it happens to form this particular contact or transition state. In the presence of this mutation, you get to form 2 hydrogen bonds. That makes that contact more stable, and it would speed up the kinetics. But for the dog, this arginine is too hard to form a hydrogen bond with. And at least our initial efforts, we weren't able to form a hydrogen bond at all. So here you'd speed up the kinetics. Here you'd greatly slow down the kinetics. That's why you would get the disease inherited here and why the dogs would be immune to the disease over there. Okay, well, that's where I'll stop. Amyloid diseases are these emergent and generic collective stabilization of protein structure. They involve that, I should say. They can be intrinsically slow, as in Huntington's disease and prions, where there's a room for quantitative modeling from physical scientists. I showed you that, without all the details, that our simple aggregation model on a neuron surface for prions can help to possibly account for the distribution of timescales in infectious and spontaneous prion disease. That membranes mediate toxicity, that part was shown by the experimentalists, but also they're necessary for the exponential growth of prion disease, that was shown by us. And that this domain swapping can play a role in the formation of these aggregate structures of the prion disease. And then finally, I mentioned, and we're actually doing some work on this as well, but I didn't feel like I could present it yet, but amyloid formation is possibly playing a role in surprising places like cancer and in the propagation of AIDS. And so with that, I'll stop and thank you for your attention. Oh, in this modeling, I actually use zero quantum mechanics. H bar equals zero. Where we have used quantum mechanics in some modeling of these diseases is if you talk about the binding of the metal ions, then you have to have quantum mechanics to look at the binding affinities for the metal ions. You use density functional theory to describe that piece of the problem, and then you can use the classical physics to describe the rest. And the quantum mechanics is implicit in that all of the potentials used in the molecular mechanics simulations, those are derived from quantum calculations on sub-pieces of the problem.